So thank you all for coming. Tonight's talk will provide some context and I hope some helpful foundation of a sort for the class that I'll be offering beginning next week on Dogen Phukan's Zangya 5 class series that will meet every other week. So we'll be focusing on this teaching in the class, and the subsequent talks that I give through mid-July will also have this focus. So those of you who are around will have something of an immersion in this teaching. Phukan's Zengi is translated in English, Universal Guidelines for Zazen. Sorry, I just realized I'm not recording. The first part of the talk will be about the relationship between Dogen's teaching and that of his predecessors in the Soto Zen lineage. And the second part of tonight's talk will focus on the teaching of one of our oldest, most celebrated Soto Zen ancestors, because his teaching features prominently in Dogen's Phukan's Zengi in a way that I think many people are unaware of. And for that matter, his teaching is echoed and alluded to in many of Dogen's essays and Dharma Hall lectures. Studying and contemplating Dogen's teaching in the context of a lineage is very important in the Zen tradition. His teaching references, is in conversation with, and stands on the shoulders of his teacher and many other teachers and ancestors in the lineage, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And whether or not you'll be taking the class, I hope that you'll find some of this illuminating and that you won't regard the historical details, including several names that I'll mention, as academic. Because I think of what I'll be sharing as the warp and woof of the relational intimate transmission from teacher to student, from one generation to the next. I think of it as highlighting the continuity of what we call the bloodline of the ancestors' samadhi, which continues to this day. I know that I found it very illuminating, clarifying, and instructive over the years as a practitioner to orient to Dogen's teaching as existing in the context of a Zen lineage, rather than focusing on and effectively isolating Dogen's particular literary genius, you know, his poetic craft, as often happens, in a way that obscures the many, many references and allusions to the realizations and teaching words of many of the Zen masters who came before him. Ancestors whose teachings he brought back to Japan, teachings that would largely constitute what would become known as Dogen's Soto Zen Buddhism in Japan, and later here in the West. He brought back to Japan an entire lineage, transmitted teacher to student, face to face, over many hundreds of years in China, and before that in India, dating back thousands of years even to Shakyamuni Buddha. This contextualizing, as I'm describing it, is, I believe, particularly important in our modern day and age, because so much of mainstream culture in the West is ahistorical and extractive and tends toward not honoring ancestors and remembering and admitting that so much, if not everything, that we have to offer is inheritance. An extractive orientation tends toward what I call cherry picking, you know, taking what resonates with our kind of deluded minds and leaving the rest. rather than honoring the entire tree, you know, roots, trunk, branches, leaves, as well as those tasty bits that we call fruit. And I think, you know, this is somewhat paradoxical, but I think that it's only when we can appreciate this entire tree that we can appreciate and awaken to the meaning of koans, like what happens when the tree withers and the leaves fall. Soto Zen speaks of an unbroken lineage dating back to Shakyamuni Buddha, and at the same time acknowledges what we call the seven Buddhas before Buddha. You know, never mind the Buddhas before the seven Buddhas before Buddha, which we also acknowledge. But we usually speak of Buddhism as having begun with Shakyamuni Buddha, or with Shakyamuni Buddha's transmission of the mind seal to his foremost disciple and first successor, Mahakashapa. I sometimes think of Shakyamuni Buddha as just one among many ancient emissaries of the Dharma, as a kind of perfected manifestation of the formless truth, a manifestation that naturally comes into being in a world in response to suffering beings, in order to give rise to point to and support an awakening that can liberate us from the fundamental delusions that we suffer. Many people think of Soto Zen Buddhism as a Japanese school of Zen. But I think that this way of thinking can be very misleading for those of us who are not very well informed. This practice and its realizations began, well, you know, I want to say it began in India, which is where Buddhism was born, with Shakyamuni. But if we consider the Buddhas before Buddha, you know, we don't really know where they all resided. But anyway, Buddhism traveled with Bodhidharma from India to China, and with Dogen from China to Japan, and then several centuries later from Japan to us here in the West. It's said that the first Zen ancestor in China was Bodhidharma, who was Indian, and he's believed to have brought the authentic teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha to China, not in books, but in the form and expression of his own embodied realization. The second ancestor was a Chinese man by the name of Weka. He was the one who cut off his own arm while standing waist deep in the snow to express his sincere wish to receive the teaching from Bodhidharma. I mean, many of our stories are apocryphal, you know, legendary, and we don't necessarily accept them as literal truth, but as pointing to something. The third ancestor was the author of the Xinxin Ming. I have a difficult time pronouncing his Chinese name, Zhang Zhe Zengzhan, which is Kanshi Sosan in Japanese. And the fourth ancestor was Dai Daoxin, who's best known for having established the monastic order, which was a big shift from the solitary hermit tradition in China. And the fifth ancestor, Hongren, is most famous for his disciple, Weinong. And Weinong is one of the most well-known, famous Chinese Soto Zen ancestors. And it's Weinong whose teachings I plan to give some special attention to tonight. Weinong was the founder of the Southern School of Zen, which is associated with sudden enlightenment. And his teachings were largely based on the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutras, the Great Perfection of Wisdom teachings. And the story goes that he was suddenly awakened when he heard someone reciting a passage from the Diamond Sutra. Weinong's considered the last of the six great patriarchs of Chan Buddhism. I just listed the six for you. Because not long after Weinong passed, within about 100 years, we say, figuratively speaking, the tradition bursted into the five petals of Zen. The five petals of Zen is the five houses, the five schools of Zen. And one of those houses was the Caodong school, which would later be pronounced Soto Zen in Japan, based on the Sino-Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese characters. In the Caodong school, many of the teachings associated with Weinong remained central and were transmitted through many generations, through Dogen, to the present day. And the founder of the Caodong school was Dongshan. He's actually said to be the co-founder, but we often say he's the founder of the Caodong school, but he co-founded it with his disciple, Caoshan Benji. And Dogen was born about 400 years after Dongshan. And so nearly 400 years after Dongshan died, Dogen met his Caodong teacher, Tiantang Ruxing, in China, who transmitted the lineage to him. So that is a condensed version of the early Chan lineage that I wanted to share tonight. For some of you, it's review, and I think that for all of us, it's wonderful to be reminded of this long lineage of transmitted teachings that Dogen received and that later our contemporaries and teachers received and we have received from them. So now, as I said, I would like to give some focused attention to Weinong's influence on Dogen's teaching. How many of you are familiar with the Platform Sutra? You know the story fairly well. Would anyone like to tell it? Just kidding. We don't have time for me to tell the entire first part of the story, which is autobiographical. It's about Weinong's life, and but I'll share a few things just so that I can get to the verses that Weinong wrote and that are part of the Platform Sutra. Weinong was born into a very impoverished family. I think the story goes that his father was basically exiled, probably something to do with the changing of the guard in the imperial court, and he was sent to the south, and which was considered a very kind of fairly uncivilized part of the country at that time. And he died when Weinong was very young, and Weinong went on to be responsible for supporting his family. I believe it was just him and his mother, as the story goes, and he began collecting and selling firewood to make money. And one day, as at this point he was a young man, during his usual rounds selling wood in a one of the shops, he overheard someone reciting some lines. And when he heard them, he had a great awakening. And he approached the man and said, "What is that you were chanting, and where did you hear that?" And he said, "I was just paying my respects to the fifth ancestor, Hongren, at the monastery. And while I was there, there were thousands of lay people and monks who he told that if you memorize this Diamond Sutra, you will see your nature and become a Buddha." And at that, as this Platform Sutra goes, Weinong felt a tug from his past life and decided to put all of his affairs in order and to depart for the monastery. And when he arrived at the gate, he met Hongren, who gave him a hard time, as Zen masters often do, maybe to test him. When he arrived, he said, "Where are you from, and what do you expect to receive here?" And Weinong recounted having heard the lines that were chanted, and he said, I met a disciple of yours who told me that you said, if you chant the Diamond Sutra, you'll become a Buddha. And I'm here because I want to become a Buddha. And Hongrun said, how can someone like yourself, I think he referred to him as a jungle rat, become a Buddha? And Weinong said, people are from the north and south, but how can our true nature differ? The master's life and my life are different, but how can our Buddha nature be different? And when Hongren heard this, he recognized that this man had seen something and was about to acknowledge when he noticed that there was another monk nearby, so he just sent Weinong to the mill, somewhere in the back of the monastery, to work. Fast forward, at some point, Hongren was thinking about wanting to give transmission to one of his monks, and he invited them to write and post a poem or a gatha. And most of the monks, intimidated by what would be equivalent to our like a tonto, decided to refrain from posting and leave it to him. So he posted a gatha, and one day while in the mill, there was a novice monk walking by, and Weinong heard him reciting this gatha. And when he heard it, he realized this person, whoever has written this, has not seen completely, has not really broken through. And he asked, you know, who wrote that? And the monk told him about this, sometimes it's called a contest, that this poetry contest. And Weinong asked if he would show him to the master's quarters, where he had never been, to see this poem. And when he arrived, he asked someone to read it to him because he was illiterate. And the poem was the following. The body is the Bodhi tree. The mind is like a bright mirror. Time and again, polish it diligently. Do not let dust alight. That was written by a monk who would later become known as Master Sheng Shui. And when Weinong saw and heard that poem, he had another insight into what is most important. And he said, I would like you to write a gatha for me on the column. And this was the gatha that he had written. Bodhi is fundamentally without any tree. The bright mirror also has no stand. Originally, there is not a single thing. Where could dust alight? And then as the Platform Sutra goes, he said, because he's telling this story of what happened, he says, and then I composed another one. And the second one was, the mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror stand. The mirror itself is so clean, dust has no place to land. So there's a lot in the Platform Sutra that is a wonderful story. I recommend it, that I don't have time to tell you tonight. I'll just go on to say that Weinong is best known for his teachings on formlessness, sudden awakening, and non-duality, which they both imply. And his teachings, as I said earlier, I think were very much steeped in the Great Perfection of Wisdom teachings, in the understanding that complete perfect wisdom, as different than worldly wisdom, arises from within our own being and is not obtained from the outside, and that we all have the potential to awaken to our true nature. Some of the ways in which this understanding is expressed in Dogen's writing, in the Fukan Zazengi, for example, are actually echoes and sometimes slight revisions of Wei Nong's famous words. You can very clearly hear in the first verse of Wei Nong's that I wrote what I would call the absolute or direct teaching, his emphasis on formlessness. And the second verse I would call an indirect or relative conventional teaching. And I think the fact that he added that second verse, as he states in the Platform Sutra, and then I composed another one, was so important in the way that it upheld the fundamental Mahayana teaching of two truths, the formless and form, the ultimate and the conventional, not two, not separate. So the formless teaching is accompanied by the teaching of form, wherein he refers to the body, the tree, the mirror stand. In the first gatha, he's negating each of these things. And in the second gatha, he brings them back in. Here's the first. Bodhi is fundamentally without any tree. The bright mirror also has no stand. Originally, there is not a single thing. Where could dust alight? And then he wrote, the mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror stand. The mirror itself is so clean. Dust has no place to land. So that said, I would say it does appear that Wei Nong was elevating the formless above the teachings on form, teachings on the physicality as we know it, given the way that his first verse came on very strong in negation of Sheng Shui's verse. When I contemplate this and Wei Nong's teaching as a whole in the Platform Sutra, not just these two verses, it's my sense that he was carefully and in a very strict way including the conventional within the ultimate, form within formlessness, and vice versa. And he emphasized the formless and its non-dual immediacy, because the formless truth, or essential nature, as we sometimes call it, is the truth to which deluded, suffering beings have not yet awakened, have not yet recognized. The existence of conventional reality is recognized. It's undisputed. But its nature, its essential nature, is not recognized or understood, and so we suffer it. The following is one of Wei Nong's teachings on formlessness that is not a negation of form, but is what I would call an illumination and clarification of form. He has the style that will require me to break this passage up a bit for clarification of posing a question and then immediately answering it. And he does this several times in a row, so it would be obvious if you were reading the text yourself, but because I'm reading it to you, I'll have to explain a bit. The passage begins, what do we mean by a form that is, in quotation marks, no form? And he answers, to be free of form in the presence of form. He goes on, and no thought? Question mark. No thought is in quotation marks. So you could say, what do we mean by no thought? And he answers, not to think about thoughts. And what do we mean by no attachment, which is everyone's basic nature? And he answers, thought after thought, not to become attached. Whether it is a past thought, a present thought, or a future thought, let one thought follow another without interruption. And I wonder if you hear in that passage what Dogen would later teach. Think not thinking. Instruction. How do you think not thinking? Question. Non-thinking. Answer. Wei Nong said, not to attach thought after thought. Sounds like Dogen's not thinking. You could say that thinking is linking thoughts, thought after thought, is attaching thoughts in a way that evokes myriad delusions. Elsewhere, Wei Nong further clarifies what he does and does not mean by no thought, which also helps to clarify why Dogen said, think not thinking, and didn't write, stop thoughts. Here's what Wei Nong said. To be unaffected by any object is what is meant by his no thought. He goes on to say, but don't think about nothing at all. Once you stop thoughts, once there's nothing at all, you die and are reborn somewhere else. Students of the way, take heed. Don't misunderstand the meaning of this teaching. In other words, don't think that no thought means something vacuous and essentially dead. He continues, what does no in no thought negate? And what is this thought in no thought about? No negates dualities and their afflictions. And thought is thought about the original nature of reality. So let's remember that to Wei Nong, no thought means not to think about thoughts. But it does not mean to think about nothing or to stop thoughts, which would mean death. He goes on, reality is the body of thought. The isness of thought. And thought is the function of reality, the function of the isness. I think that Wei Nong's no thought is a description of what Dogen called non-thinking. Thought free of dualities and their afflictions, free of attachment, thought that illuminates the original nature of thoughts, the body of thought itself. As for the sudden or direct nature of his teachings, as he's known for, those expressions are often misunderstood as no need for practice, no need for cultivation. So, here's another passage from Wei Nong that refers to sudden teaching or realization, not as a negation of gradual or indirect teaching, but simply in contrast. People refer to Wei Nong of the south and Chen Shui of the north, but they don't know the real reason for this. He goes on to say that it's because I lived in the south and he lived in the north. And continues, there's only one school of Buddha Dharma, but people are from the north or south. This is why we use the terms northern and southern. And what is the origin of direct and indirect? Although there is only one Buddha Dharma, understanding can be fast or slow. When understanding is slow, we say it is indirect. And when understanding is fast, we say it is direct. The Dharma isn't direct or indirect. It is people who are sharp or dull. So when Dogen writes in the Fukan Zazengi, between the dull and the sharp-witted, there is no distinction. He's not saying there's no distinction between what is sharp and dull. If there were no distinction, we wouldn't have these two different words, sharp and dull, and what they point to. He's saying that there's no distinction between your original face and my original face. Whether you're from the north or the south, whether your mind is sharp or dull, no distinction between the original face of Master Hongren and that of an illiterate jungle rat like Wei Nong. That original nature is what we call Buddha nature or essential nature. Wei Nong continues, good friends, the Dharma isn't direct or indirect. It's people who are sharp or dull. For those who are deluded, there is indirect persuasion. For those who are aware, there is direct cultivation. Know your mind and see your nature. For those who are aware, there is basically no separation. For those who aren't aware, there are infinite kalpas on the wheel of rebirth, on the wheel of samsara. Birth and death coming and going, round and round. As we study the Fukan Zazengi together, those of you who will be joining over the next couple of months, we'll continue to consider Wei Nong's teachings as they are echoed by Dogen. And I'd like to end the talk tonight with a quote, another quote from Wei Nong that encourages us to do the practice, to engage fully with body and mind. And this passage also ties tonight's talk together with the topic of the last talk that I gave here on attention to space, which included Dogen's and Ruijing's references to empty space, which not surprisingly were predated by Wei Nong's teachings on space. This is Wei Nong. Mahaprajna Paramita is Sanskrit. In our language, it means the great wisdom that leads to the other shore. This teaching must be practiced and not simply chanted with your mouth. If you chant it with your mouth, but you don't practice it, it's like an illusion or a mirage. But the Dharma body of those who practice it is the same as a Buddha's. What does Maha mean? Maha means great. The capacity of the mind is so great, it's like space. But if you practice empty mind Zen, and here, I don't know what the characters were, but I think he means vacuous mind, you will fall into a featureless void. In this world of ours, space has room for the sun and moon and the stars, the earth and its mountains and rivers, every plant and tree, bad people and good people, bad teachings and good teachings, heavens and hells. All of this exists in space. The emptiness of our nature, and now he's using emptiness in the way that we do in the teaching of Buddhism. The emptiness of our nature is also like this. Our nature contains the 10,000 dharmas. That's how great it is. And the 10,000 dharmas are our nature. To see humans and non-humans, both the good and the bad, good dharmas and bad dharmas, without rejecting them and without being corrupted by them, this is to be like space. This is what we mean by great. This is what maha means. Deluded people chant this with their mouths. The wise practice it with their mind. There are also deluded people who call having a vacuous mind and not thinking great. But that isn't how this works. The capacity of the mind is great, but if you don't use it, it is small. Thank you for your attention. Something I thought to say at the beginning, but didn't, just for those of you who are newer, but so those of you who have been around for a while, you may not have heard. You know, there are 3 or 5 different classifications of traditional Dharma Hall lectures. You know, one is Taisho. Another is Kogi, which is more of a historical kind of an analytical teaching. Taisho is more of a direct seeing, offering something that allows you to see directly. More often, we receive these kinds of teachings during sesshin. They're often shorter. They're not so linear or rational. They bypass that kind of syllogistic mind. And there's another, I want to say, Kowa, or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but it refers to teachings that are practice instructions and ways to help you bring the practice into your everyday life. And all of these different kinds of teachings have their time and place. And as I was preparing this talk, I was thinking that this talk is more along the lines of a teaching that's provides some historical explanatory information as well as some instruction on how to practice. And because there are passages from our ancestors, some of you may be able to hear them in a way that offers some direct seeing. If you have any questions or anything you'd like to share.
Thank you, Kristen, for a wonderful talk. I really appreciated how you connected Wei Nung's teachings to how it's reflected by Dogen. And that's the question I have, which is, I have two questions. The first one, where you quoted Wei Nung for distinguishing between direct and indirect, that it's, you know, it's sharp-witted and not sharp-witted versus, you know, the Buddha mind is the same for everyone. Was that, were you quoting from the Platform Sutra? Is it, because
Yes, all of the quotes, all the passages that I read were from the Platform Sutra. There were places where I inserted something for clarification.
Yeah.
As I said, I would, but all of the passages are from Platform Sutra, which as far as I know is the only recorded teaching of Wei Nong's that we have.
And you, this really amplified a statement that you had made several weeks ago, probably in our study group, about the where you clarified the idea of sudden realization, and you said, well, it's a misnomer that Zen is really a school of sudden realization, and so this really amplified that statement. That was a short statement you made, but
there is more to it than that, I confess, and I think that it was Todd who said. Was it Todd? Someone else in the class, I thought, made a nice comment about it can be both. It is both, sudden and gradual.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons Wei Nong's teaching was understood as direct and sudden was because there was so much at that time that was about all these purification practices and so many things that one had to do and learn and study that were believed to be required, you know, and we say in this tradition, the family jewels don't come in through the front gate. It was kind of a challenge to that idea of people feeling like there was so much to get and to gain and so many purification practices that were required. And Wei Nong had a recognition that allowed him to help people to see more directly. However, if you read the entire Platform Sutra, there are many things there about ethical, you know, behavior and practice. So it's not a negation. It's both and.
And so thank you. Yeah. My main question was in the back of my mind, and I can't place, you know, I can't cite where I read this or heard this. I just know I've heard it, that Dogen was not a fan of the Platform Sutra. I've heard you've heard that.
Yes.
It's been circulated, but you very beautifully showed the synergy there. So I happen to have a fondness for the Platform Sutra, and you know I wouldn't say Dogen be damned, but whatever Dogen's thoughts were, you know, even if he were not a fan of the Platform Sutra, it wouldn't have changed my love for the Platform Sutra. So. Could you help me?
Well, I don't know if I can, but what comes to my mind is Dogen contains multitudes. Another way of saying it is you can find a lot of contradictory statements throughout his teachings, including he was not a fan of teachings on Buddha nature. But if you read many of his essays, you see it right there, Buddha nature. Described in so many of the ways that Buddha nature is described. I hesitate to say this, but I, based on what I have written and including the commentary of scholars like Carl Bielefeld, you know, Dogen was rather sectarian, and there was a lot of sectarian competition, like in Japan at that time. And so I think the climate influenced many things that Dogen said. That, and then later, many years later, he revised things that he said. So we have to consider it all.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I was in Berkeley yesterday and went into a bookstore. I went into Mo's and picked up a book of Tibetan Buddhism, and which this question will be ironic given that we decided not to read Tibetan analysis of the Heart Sutra. But nonetheless, my question is about your talk the last time about space, which you mentioned again today. And just something caught my attention pretty sharply, which was the discussion of Rigpa. You familiar with Rigpa? So the opening up of all the senses as a practice, which I think sort of floods the mind, or I wonder if there's a sense that you have of how that practice, and I realize it's unfair to talk about a Tibetan practice in a Zen group, and yet how does that relate to the space that you're talking about and to thinking, not thinking?
I'm not a Tibetan practitioner, and I read some Tibetan teachings, and there are a couple of Tibetan teachers whose teaching I really resonate with, but I don't and have never had any particular Tibetan practices. I'm a Zen practitioner. But the way it relates in my mind is this is a response to your question about the mind being flooded when you have a wider, when you widen the aperture, so to speak. And it's really just a matter of stabilizing attention. For many people, they need to narrow their attention and keep the attention on something, a very smaller object, because we have so much habit energy. You know, the mind's constantly bouncing around. Everything that comes into the field pulls you off. And so if you have something small to return to, so much of this practice is returning, it's easier for many people in the beginning. And when you widen the aperture, you can feel like the mind is, you know, bouncing everywhere. However, this think not thinking, that has a lot to do with how you relate to thoughts. If every thought that passes through your mind you try to like get a hold of, or you start linking them to each other, then you're going to be pulled around when you widen, you know, the aperture of your attention. But if you can allow thoughts to come and go, allow what comes to come, allow what goes to go, like clouds or leaves blowing through, and to not be pulled around, then experientially the effect of that is different than maintaining a narrow focus. You're welcome.
Thank you. I was most intrigued by your presentation of the two poems that, and I thought that was Wayne Ng at his best, you know. And you know, one time he expressed it from the side of formlessness or emptiness, and the next time he kind of expressed it from form. Mm-hmm. And It what was intriguing and to encounter again was that the two poems draw this, still come to the same place. So whether you take, you know, this is more of a comment, I guess, but whether you take the path of form or formlessness, the mirror is. And Hui Ning's telling is still without dust,
yes.
Still free and clear.
Yes.
And this is the way you drew that out. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Kirsten. I was just reflecting. I wonder if you have any thoughts about what was the fact that the sixth ancestor was illiterate. I wonder how that might have affected his formulation and teachings of form and formlessness, because words are form. And as a person who's literate, when I'm speaking, I have in my head some sense of those words that are in a written form. But a person who is illiterate doesn't have that same experience in their head because they don't recognize form as a word. And I'm just wondering what, because it seems like that might have actually been a way that opened his eyes to seeing in a way that people who were literate don't see. Mm-hmm. Because very often I think sometimes people who are literate are on the slow side because you get so sucked into studying, you know, all the texts and the sutras, and that's what I'm doing. And I tend to go down that path because I'm a literate person. But this is just, it came to me, maybe that's part of my problem in understanding suddenly, is I'm a literate person.
Yes, I agree. As soon as you started to speak I wanted to say, yeah, it was probably to his advantage.
Yes.
Because so many of our conceptualization is just, we're so caught up in a lot of constructs that don't actually land anywhere.
And have no existence. They're all in our head because they're with a word that's in this particular form that in one language, in English it's written one way, in Chinese it's written in a different form, but it solidifies and petrifies in a way the thought.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. And in fact, in the Platform Sutra, there's some place where he addresses this by saying that, I don't remember the exact words, but that the oral transmission is more direct and that the written words are indirect and can be a hindrance.
I have one example that I was reading that, and this was a linguist blog that I was on for some strange reason, but that in the Greek language, there was no word for blue. Now, if you read the Iliad, they don't talk about the blue sea. They talk about the wine-dark sea. And it's striking that they never call the sea blue. And this linguist says, well, there was no word in the language. And it's not that they didn't have the same eyes that we had and that different peoples had, but it's that interpretation through words about what you're seeing.
And you don't think that wine dark landed on what we see as blue? You think that wine dark was them seeing a different color than what we see when we say the word blue?
No, they were seeing the same, because it's the same sea. The sea hasn't changed. The reflection and the wavelength that comes into human eyes comes into all human eyes. But it was the word, the language that put a word on it. And they didn't have that specific word for a blue, but it was an analogy word. So a different way of thinking about what is a universal human experience, which is water and the light that's reflected on water into our eye. But it's our language and our thought that changes that experience. So I think in terms of direct experience, direct experience is no thought. In that analogy.
Sarah, maybe Linda calling Katie? I don't know if she knows she's been calling.
Hi, Katie, can you hear us?
Okay, yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much, Kristen.
Welcome.
I have been rereading the Platform Sutra too, and it was so good to hear it read aloud. That's the way it was delivered, and it just sounded so different to hear that passage read aloud when I just recently read it. So thank you for that. And I loved hearing the connection between Dogen and the different ancestors. I think he is put in isolation a lot. In the West, and yet the ancestors are all over the place. If you read Dogen's extensive record, he references the ancestors all the time. And I love the book Cultivating the Empty Field. I keep rereading that one too, like one passage at a time. And then when I read Dogen, I just see Hongzhi all over the place in Dogen. So it's wonderful to hear these connections. So thank you.
Welcome. I almost said something about Hongzhi. I was curious. I was looking in the Ehe Kroku, the collected works of Dogen, and I have an electronic copy, and sometimes I'm curious about how many times something appears, and so I can do a search. And Weinong's name came up more than 150 times, if I remember correctly.